Well, at BizNews, we do like to get involved in the big stories, the big issues. And something that our community is extremely mindful of, as we are, any thinking South African, is this whole story about national health insurance. And in many ways, you've got to understand why the government is driving it so hard, because its constituency, and that's most people in South Africa, do not have access to medical aid. Of course, the wealthy people do, but the reason they don't have access is it's damn expensive. The medical aid system in South Africa does not look after poorer people. Maybe not in future, though. Rhonda Notta is the founder of the National Healthcare Group. We at BizNews are very proud to be partnering with Rhonda in this initiative. And we are hoping that when you get to know this guy, and as we go forward, we'll have webinars and introduce the alternative product to high-cost medical aids, you'll also see that there is a difference. There is something that can work better than NHI. And once again, we can get this private sector to come to the party where perhaps government's going to make a big mess of it. All right, I'm saying a lot of stuff there, Rhonda, and I don't really want to get into political issues, but I want to find out more about you from the tribe. You are a medical doctor. I know you don't come from lots of money, so doing a medical degree would have required quite a bit of either very good marks or bursaries or lots of debt or hard work on the side. How did you get your medical degree together?
Thank you, Eric. It wasn't an automatic choice. I did a few other half degrees and eventually settled on medicine. And indeed, the cost was reflected in my final year's debt. I think if I look today, it was a huge debt. But I always knew as a doctor, one should be able to somehow manage that. So loaned from various banks. I remember as a first year, you go to one bank, you get a loan, you have to have a little white lie because the next bank says, have you already got a loan? You say, not yet. And so you get to, you know, those days, there wasn't any way of double checking. So mostly debt and some bursaries. And it took me 6-7 years to get my degree. And one of the ways of paying it back was those days, and many today still, you go to the UK and you work very hard for a year. And that was also what I did.
So you went to the UK, worked in their national health system?
In their national health service, as what they call SHO, senior health officer. South Africans were very popular. So mostly you work in trauma and then you do stints in the casualties. And you are able to locum in the days off. Again, people didn't quite know it. So we often worked sometimes at two hospitals within 24 hours. And then in your week off, we went in private hospitals where you could also work. So you have an agent and they post you. And nobody quite knows how many hours you clock, but it was a fantastic experience.
Sounds to me like hard work is not an issue for you.
No, I think that's part. I mean, I think any doctor today still, particularly your junior doctors, and even then, you know, hard work is something that you could control and make the most of it. And I think we were taught that hard work is important.
We were taught by your family?
Yeah, I think as young children already, 12-year-olds, we often did our own thing, worked in the garden, sold radishes and carrots and always did something to earn money. And eventually in school as well, always worked in some shop, ShopRite typically, many years in fact. And then eventually got through medicine.
You got to tell me about ShopRite because I come from a small town called Newcastle. And I remember when Checkers opened up there, it was a big event because we kids could go and pack trolleys. And you would pack the trolleys for the people who had been buying and take the trolley to their car, usually older people, unpack, and they'd give you 5 cents. Or hopefully it was a bit more than that. Was that the kind of gig that you were doing as well?
Slightly more formal. So I remember I was in grade, standard 8, grade 10, and I went to the Belleville ShopRite to on the search for a job. And I saw an old man with a little S on his badge, and that was Mr. B, as I called him, one of the founders of the regional shop, right? And he simply said to me, "In what shop can you work?" And he didn't know that I came all the way from Oosterivier, not far from Stellenbosch, so he ended up posting me to Wasco, just north of Goodwood. And that was my first official job as a packer behind the toll. There were only two packers, and then eventually I graduated to become on the toll and then eventually a checkout supervisor. And that role actually kept me busy until my second year. So I did, I think for nearly 7 years, I worked for ShopRite over weekends and holidays.
What did you learn from that?
One is that complaining customers are the most valuable customers, because if a customer comes to you with a complaint, they took the trouble, and if you can fix that complaint, they are loyal for life. And that I learned from one of the managers in Coles Riviera. Yeah. I'll never forget, the customer came in with a Pick and Bay bag, but inside was a ShopRite bulk. And I suspected foul play. And he said, "No, everyone has various bags at home." And then we swapped the milk, and the lady was so impressed. And we knew she, and then he just said, "You know, this lady did the trouble to bring back some off milk, and we have her forever now." And that, I think, is a critical thing. Customers that complain are important customers. They're not the nuisance ones. It's the quiet customers that stay away.
Randa, so now you qualify as a doctor. You go to the UK. You've got some hard currency which will help to pay off your debts. How long did you stay as a GP or practice as a GP for?
So that year was year one, after obviously my houseman year in South Africa, which I still did at Conradie Hospital. And then I came back and I got a job at Red Cross Children's Hospital. And I worked there for a year. And then another year or two in the private practices before I basically left clinical medicine and started looking at low-cost models. It started quite early already.
Wow. Was that from what you saw at the Red Cross
Hospital? Yeah, I think the Red Cross Hospital was a fantastic a learning experience, because it was the same time in South Africa with the dawn of the new South Africa, and Mr. Mandela made an announcement shortly after he became president that all children under six would have free access to healthcare. And that meant obviously that Red Cross suddenly was basically overwhelmed by patients. And I was one of those doctors who on a normal day would have seen maybe 20 to 30 patients, and now it's 120.
And there, how do you see 120 patients on a day?
Well, with difficulty. you just had to see them very fast. And there was a triaging nurse, so you had to support. And many babies in particular, you know, are not necessarily very ill. You quickly see that, but the mothers are concerned and they need to just be seen. So we did see sometimes, not always, but I mean, sometimes we saw a lot of patients, particularly on long weekends. But there I realized that the private sector has to come to the party, because this trend in South Africa, you know, no government institution can also cope like this. And I started looking at models already then, very naively those days, to how the private sector could do something to help.
So you've got the medical background, you've got the entrepreneurial spirit, clearly, because you've worked every spare minute, including as a packer, and then I was a till boy in a health shop for a while with my wife, so kind of know what the till boy series is, and then even a supervisor. So you've got those two parts, and what then? What do you do from there to pursue this low-cost model? Because that's really the big story that we're looking at.
Yeah, so interesting. Three of the ventures I got involved with, where I was appointed as having some role, often the medical director or the GP connector. Three of those initiatives failed, and three times we went bust. And then the fourth time I started a company called Care Cross Health, and it actually did well in the end. It was also a rocky start, but 15 years later it was sold to a big insurance company. And that was really the basis for my experience, where we, for the first time, took GPs in South Africa and sort of shared risk with them. In other words, you offer him a fee per member per month, and then, you know, it's based on the old Chinese saying, you pay a doctor as long as you're healthy and you stop when you're sick. That model, where the incentives should be on curative medicine. And we pioneered that in South Africa. We also were the first company then to have a network of GPs. where that wasn't really done before. You know, doctors were very much independent and untouchable in many ways. And we then branded them to say, if you go to this particular doctor, the costs are less, you know, your medicines are maybe based on a more generic model. And that was something that we very successfully pioneered. Today, it's more or less the norm. And that's how I entered into low-cost healthcare.
How many doctors did you have?
So initially, about 1,200 out of South Africa's GPs. That was sort of roughly the right coverage for all of South Africa to be able to sign up a client with many, say, many stores or many branches, because we needed one in every town. And in my heyday, I literally drove and met maybe 5,000 private doctors to meet them and see which ones could be part of the network, because not all doctors necessarily have that same inclination. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, some doctors are in very wealthier areas. Their whole focus is maybe on something that doesn't fit the low-cost model, you know, and that's normal. We have a very diverse society. So some GPs maybe focus more on things like aesthetics or youth medicine, you know, how to say younger. So there's certain doctors who are not appropriate for this. But the doctor with a golden heart closer to the taxi rank, so to speak, those were the ones we targeted. And we were very successful in binding them in a network in order to then sell products to medical aides that could then on-sell to their lower-income earners.
Aesthetics. I only heard that for the first time here in Hermanus. It means plastic surgery for the rest of us.
Sometimes a bit of Botox.
Oh, so that's kind of the other end of the scale. How many people, though, did you bring into the medical aid system through the company was started there?
It was a lot those days, but still a drop in the bucket. And we're looking at probably about 350,000 people.
Not a drop in any bucket.
But that's keep in mind, it comes from a massive pool. Today, you know, in terms of just the stats, we have about 70 million people, of which roughly 8 million have medical aid. And maybe another sort of 5 million have some form of healthcare cover, you know. But that leaves a lot of people without any real access except going to clinics or go to GPs and pay out of their own pockets.
So I would have thought that you had a good start there, 350,000 lives covered. You're on your road. You've been doing it for 15 years. That is your mission in life. Why give up? Why sell out?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Entrepreneurs in sell out often. And what happened here is in the course of the 15 years that I ran CareCross, we often needed capital. So we slowly got more and more other shareholders on board, corporate shareholders with different aims than maybe me as a founder. And at some point, the shareholders saw it fit to sell, and maybe it was the right thing to do then. It did give me an opportunity to then just sit back for a while and restart, which I did about 7 years ago with this initiative. Because what wasn't really available those days, which is available today, was elements of technology. You know, there were no cell phones really. There wasn't WhatsApp. There wasn't the capability to access AI. So there's a new world that wasn't there those days. And if you combine that world, which is what we do with existing GPs, you have a very powerful model.
Yeah, I forget, of course. I had the same thing. I started off, it was my company, but then you bring in investors, and over time, you no longer control the company, and that's fine. But then the investors want different things, perhaps, from the more idealistically driven entrepreneurs, which I can see we do share a little bit on that side. So you sell out, you now got plenty of money in the bank. Did you take any fishing trips or trips around the world or just kind of kick back?
No, funny enough, not. We did end up acquiring a little farm, which became a beautiful guest lodge. But we, I was a small shareholder in the end. Because as a doctor, essentially a doctor is a guy that has a medical degree and matric. One mustn't forget that. So the business side of it wasn't strongly developed with me. I had a good CFO, had a strong chairman. They were the experts in the business side. I just ran the healthcare side. And that sometimes allows for you know, a situation that although I ran it all, I didn't end up having all of it at the end. But most investors have a mindset of 5 to 7 years, and healthcare is a long-term play. So when they were ready to sell out, and we had a big insurance company wanting to buy us. And
who was it?
That was Momentum.
That bought us. Proper company, yeah.
And the product still runs with them. But it's not low enough in terms of the mass market needs, in my view. So although it is a good product and many companies are on it, and it's still a huge success today, we have a need for something even lower. And that's what I'm focusing on now.
Help me understand that. How wasn't low enough and something lower? So CareCross, the first company, was one where you learned a heck of a lot from, undoubtedly. Yeah. But what did it teach you? And in the price points, I guess that's really the point that we're talking about here for what you call the National Healthcare Group.
Yeah, I think the major thing was that the cost that companies can bear to subsidize their low-income workers with, there's a limit. And so those days we ended up, say, 400 or 500 rand per person per month for access to primary care. That's important to note. It's not hospitals and specialists. We find that for us to really sign up the next base of that pyramid of maybe the next 4 or 5 million people, we need to be closer to 200 rand a month.
200 rand a month. And what do you get for that?
So if you combine technology, which is a fantastic tool to defray certain costs, particularly access, and what we use is WhatsApp and a nursing triage panel, and then doctors on the same model. And when they are stuck, let's call it that way, then we have 3,000 South African GPs in their own rooms where we refer to. And then the price can come down quite dramatically, because now everyone has access via his little cell phone to a nurse that can hear him out or her out and then give advice, send a script over the phone. And if you need more than that, then we literally make an appointment for you at your doctor, wherever you are. And with 3,000 GPs, we roughly cover all of South Africa and even Namibia to do this. And it's interesting. I sometimes do a demo of the WhatsApp, and I've done it in Amsterdam at the head office of Philips, you know, and that oak there would have got the same healthcare that anyone here has, because WhatsApp allows for that. So it is a model that is transplantable over borders, because if you, like in Namibia, we have a case where you have a few doctors that once the nurse sees she needs more help, they refer to those specific doctors, you know, and that model, I think, is going to go very far.
Where were you? Do you remember the circumstances where you decided, this is what I'm going to do now? I'm going to start something that, not the 500 rand a month, I'm really going to get into the average South African can.
So I know exactly where I was. I was reading a book, and that book was Helen Zille's book, Not Without a Fight.
Go on.
And when I read that book, and I looked at her being a little bit more my senior, and then thinking, you know, if she can basically in many ways save the country, then I can at least, with the knowledge I've got, give it another bash.
Well, let's hope she can save Joburg for a starting point. Exactly. The country might take a bit longer. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So she inspired you.
It's a very motivational book. I mean, it's a great book from a purely contemporary history perspective, but also from perseverance, you know. And I mean, we forget that the Western Cape also was once the ANC run. And by very few votes and a lot of hard work, it got swayed into the DA's camp. So that was the turning point, where I then went to a very good friend of mine, Corky Kooiman, and I said, listen, I've got my deal.
Corky at Biz News.
And I said to him, you had a bite to eat at the vineyard. And I said to him, this is my plan. What do you think? And he then introduced me to some of his friends at Sanlam, and eventually at African Rainbow Capital. And eventually we've got a few very nice people that were the founding investors.
So they bought in. And particularly here, this is Patrice Motsepe's African Rainbow Capital. They bought in on an idea or on your track record?
Mostly an idea, but also, I suppose, a track record. You know, a track record of a successful sale is very valuable if you don't have that. So people also then assume that, you know, there's money to be made here. This model is a more difficult one. It's going to take longer. And one needs to have a little bit more perseverance and depth in your pockets. But it's a model that I think ultimately you can't make it any cheaper. That I'm aware, you know, that I know, because you can't have it for free. Then you're back at either in an NGO situation where you have to stand cap in hand with big people like the Gates Foundation, and I'm not in favor of that model. It doesn't work on the long run.
What, just unpack that for us.
All models.
When you said NTO, what's it?
NGO.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think all
non-government organizations.
Yeah, or not-for-profit organizations. All those organizations at some point lose their prime sponsor, you know. Nobody's giving you money forever. So it may last for 6 years, then you've got to find a new one. And I like the free market. I want to make money as well. And I think all profitable businesses are the ones that are sustainable. It's as simple as that.
Mm. So I do know the two Johans at Africa Rainbow Capital. And the two Johans can never be accused of wanting to do corporate social investment in their investments. They're looking for a sustainable model. They're looking to make money out of it. Now you've told us that your price point is 200 Rand, which for most people, they would never believe that a doctor could even see you for 200 Rand. So you're going to have to unpack that a little bit more for us.
Yeah, so the 200 Rand a month on average, there's actually an option a little bit cheaper and there's one a little bit more expensive.
Cheaper than 200?
Yeah, so there's a very basic option which includes access to a GP, access to any pharmacy in South Africa, and some x-rays and blood tests. Then a bit more, you get some dentistry and optometry as well, and chronic medication. So these are all registered insurance products with quite strict rules. So the rules need to be followed, and that is if you are on them, you can only access this via a WhatsApp. So the WhatsApp is an interesting one because you can have a bit of a AI beginning. Verify, are you really you? What are the basic issues? Keep in mind that this is primary care. In other words, if you think you've got a heart attack, don't come to us. We can't help you. Then we send you a number for an ambulance. So once we've established all of that, and that alone is typically time-consuming and expensive, that can be done from where you are in your bed. And because not everyone has maybe a cell phone that can do WhatsApp, we haven't linked this to your number. So you can use anybody's cell phone. It's only linked to your ID number, or should you be a foreign worker, your passport. And then we have nurses that will suss you out, the ability to even send a picture in case of, say, a wound or an infection. And then there's the typical nurse-based care that can be done via a script to a pharmacy, any pharmacy in South Africa. And if that doesn't work, then we step it up. You know, then you get sent to your local GP where we make the appointment and you go there. You get it with WhatsApp to say 3 o'clock today, you go to Dr. Van der Merwe. He's aware of it and he sees you. And we pay him a normal consultation fee, by the way. So it's not really...
So what is that? What's a normal...
Well, normal, there's the norm for low income, and that is done by all of us, from Discovery straight down to any medical insurance company. That's about 500 Rand per consultation. It's a bit more or a bit less, depending if whether you include medication. And then the patient goes there, he gets seen, and he's treated like anyone on any expensive medical aid.
So... I know there are a lot of people thinking, well, how does he make a business out of this? Because if it's 500 Rand a consultation, then you just better hope like heck that the people that you are covering don't go and see doctors more than once every 3 months.
Yeah. So we know the ratio on average in big pools, how many people go to the doctor per year. So we base it on that. But remember also, we are in a way the instigator of this visit. The nurse sends you there. You can't go on your own. You do have an app and it shows you where the doctors are. And there are some options that are a bit more expensive where you can go to the doctor, you know. So we cater for a range of incomes. So from roughly 150, the cost, to all the way to about 400. And in that range, some of the options, you can see a doctor directly, or you can maybe see doctor six times. But the seventh time, we need to sort of, you know, these are all techniques to defray a runaway cost.
A bit like some of the cell phone companies as well. You get uncapped broadband, but if you abuse it, you are going to be pulled up. I guess in this case, if you go and see the doctor when you aren't really sick, or if you have a bad record, well, I guess you must have some kind of option to deal with people like that.
Yeah, so you know, the nurse is always available, and she knows, or he knows, but mostly she, what to do under primary care circumstances. Because we, that way you can ensure that there's no runaway costs. Should you have a patient that is a difficult patient who seems to be repeating the nurse and so on, then you investigate, you know. The same goes with this patient that's always phoned on a Friday or a Monday. So the statistics out of this initiative are quite interesting, and we give corporates a report to say, well, so many people were sick, so many on Saturdays, on whichever days. And then we pick up trends. And I mean, companies love to know why somebody's always sick on a Saturday or a Friday. And it's something that probably we do more than any wealthy medical aid, you know. No expensive medical aid is going to even tell you that as a company. But we give them reports on exactly, not having any names involved. So the POPI Act prevents us clearly from doing that. But you can tell a company that 40 people were sick. This is what their diseases were. This is what the costs were. And in case of certain high-risk issues, like, say, someone has been diagnosed with epilepsy, you want to make sure he's not necessarily a driver, you know. And so there's a lot of occupational advantages. And that's the way you sell it to a corporate. You sell it to an individual because he needs healthcare. But companies need solutions for problems with absenteeism, problems with sick note fraud, general, you know, low morale, and healthcare addresses many of those issues.
It's got to be a morale-boosting process at pretty low cost. If you're paying 200 Rand, and that's the all-in cost. So if the company pays the 200 Rand, we say, all of our staff now, you have basic health care. We're going to pay it for you. 200 Rand a month, that's it. Or do they have to put more money in?
No. So there's a few ways of selling it. One is the most popular one, two companies, and they pay and it's done. The dilemma with a contribution from the employer, which companies can't force down, means that you still don't have everyone covered. So the 200 Rand is a bit of a magical number because it comes from the company's willingness to subsidize existing products 50%. And the best existing products are about 450. So half of that is 225. So we then simply say, well, you were prepared, if the employer was prepared, to subsidize all of them for 225. Here is a product that only costs 225. So now you're going to put everyone on, because also from a risk perspective, you can't let people choose. Of course, your sicker people will then sign on immediately, get their diabetic medication at a very low cost, and that way the model clearly can't work. So there is an element of cross-subsidization within pools, and hence the compulsory nature of this. So companies that sign up, and we've got many of them, they will put them all on, and then eventually give their employees an option to buy up, and maybe buy a normal product with, say, hospitalization included as well.
Brilliant, brilliant. You get promoted, you want to improve your medical aid, you've got the basic medical aid, which you never had before, and you would clearly feel warmer towards your employer as a result of that. Where do you start? How many employees do you have to be able to come into the system?
No, so we really, because we have the big pool, you know, they're all coming to our pool, so there's no real cutoff.
So if you've got perhaps someone who comes and does your garden for you once a week, can you?
Yeah, so the products are individuals, so you can sign up an individual, and then that's completely possible. But, you know, companies of 10 or more are ideal. But then many restaurants, many guest houses, you know, they all have between 10 and 40 employees. So that's our target market. And
restaurants, guest houses, I suppose, yeah, tourism operations
very
generally.
Much so. And also, you know, your industrial areas, the panel beating shop. I mean, there's virtually every company has a few white collar managers. They are on a normal medical aid, often to the tune of 7,000 Rand a month for them and their family. And many of their employers are nothing, you know, and the stats are quite daunting. The big gap between healthcare access in this regard. And because of that, the clinics are flooded. which then causes other problems. So now thinking is, if employed people can be seen in the private sector, at least at primary care level, then the non-employed, which is about the same number in South Africa, they then have access to the state because nobody else can look after them.
So if you've got a toothache, today you're on your own, most South Africans, you're left to try and find a way to get the tooth taken out. You might, that would mean what? Standing in a queue all day at a clinic?
Yeah, so dentistry is a good example. So our higher end products cover that. At one of nearly every dentist in South Africa is participating in that, and basic hygiene and infection control and fillings is covered by that. So no crowns and bridges, that would be too expensive. No cosmetic dentistry, but the needs, particularly pain control, is covered.
We're going to be talking a lot in the time going ahead, but something we haven't mentioned here is a quite astonishing privilege that you had in meeting Mother Teresa and how that affected this whole, I suppose, idealistic social entrepreneurial endeavor, if you like, that you're on.
Yeah, it was in my fifth year of medicine when we were requested to what they call an elective. It's still going on today. So you do something special, and many people choose to work with their local GP or at a hospital. I went to the East, and I did a stint in Bangkok, primary care development, and then a few weeks with Mother Teresa in Kolkata. And it was, in many ways, a life-changing thing.
How did you get in there?
So the course in Thailand was a primary care development course. And it's quite interesting if you look back. I wouldn't have known in my fifth year that I would one day look at low-cost healthcare, even though that was the beginning of a path. And then from there, I've known about, the whole hype around Mother Teresa. So I flew to Kolkata. Massive culture shock just landing on the airport those days. And then I just literally asked people around, where does she live? Where's her house? And it was, everyone knew. And I went there and I reported for duty. There are many volunteers, a lot of Swedish and Norwegian ladies and men that all needed to, they all worked there as cleaners for patients or washing them. And because I was a medical student, I was welcomed. And they were very ethical. You couldn't do work as a doctor yet, or, you had to do more menial tasks. So my job was in one of the houses called the Remdon House for the sick, dying, and destitute. I remember that was on the front written. And there, people that would have typically died on the sidewalks of Kolkata were then brought in on little mats in a long hall, and we were then helping them bathing and feeding. Huge numbers, massive hall. And that was let's call it the lowest possible form of low-income healthcare. I mean, there's zero income there, and she cared for them. And obviously that made a huge impact worldwide, getting her eventually the Nobel Prize. But it was a massive experience to think how far we can go if we don't sort ourselves out. And it's always stuck with me. And yeah, I came back, I took an interest in primary care. And that's how that, together with my Red Cross experience, I think got me onto this route.
So where to next for this company, for this new company of yours? New company, I suppose. How long has it been going for?
It's in many ways new now because we've done our base testing, the assumptions and so on. So now it's really getting into the market and telling everyone about it, because it is a bit of a secret still. Not everyone knows about it, and many companies need to hear about it, because I think the bottom of the pyramid model is always a difficult one to start, because you make no money for quite a while until you have enough people in. And this is such a case, both from a risk perspective as well as from an income perspective. This can only work as a big company. And I remember I just read the book on Capitec, and I know Michiel Roux, I think, was quoted by saying Capitec will be a small failure or a huge success. And I think I'm a bit in that thing as well. We're now going on nicely, but the success is now with volumes coming in and technology is ready. The GPs are all there. The pharmacies are sort of registered and ready. And I've got some nice partners. Both Old Mutual and Standard Bank are our major selling partners today, and many brokers. But it's time to scale. And it's really where many companies with great ideas make it or break it, you know, the scaling of it. And we are there now.
So you've heard the story. You're going to hear more. And in fact, we're lining up a webinar for the next couple of weeks where Randa can answer your questions. We believe that members of the BizNews tribe who own companies, and there are many, would do very well just considering bringing something, bringing some level of healthcare to all people in your employ. I know certainly from BizNews' perspective, we will all be on the program that Rand has told us about. But I can just imagine big farms, perhaps big engineering works, etc. You'd have a lot of people working for you who just, when they get sick, there is no option of going to the doctor, which many people in our community take for granted. Let's see where we can go with this. We're going to be supporting Randa, and hopefully you'll support him as well. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.